All right, we are back after dark, talking to Lomez, talking PKD, talking Noir. Going to talk a little bit about speed, among other things. I think we've got some loops we can close from the original episode. Kevin, I think
I'm shaking back and forth, and I'm watching Jesse Owens win the gold.
There you go.
Yeah. That's exciting. Wunderbar.
Oh man. So Patreon supporters, thanks for coming in. You know the score.
I got to blow kisses. Mwah. Yeah. Thank you. We really appreciate this. Truly do. And continue to support the pod. Tell people about the pod. Brad and I, this is our retirement. We're going to do this for as long as we possibly can. And every new patron we get, it brings a little twinkle in my eye. And whatever the equivalent is for Brad.
It's pretty it is pretty exciting. But, you know,
we do appreciate it, truly.
Yeah. So we'll do, let me just give you, I do want to touch on the speed thing, because like as I was saying, not because I'm a speed enthusiast or anything, but just as I'm thinking about Philip K. Dick, the
but you're a speed respecter for sure.
Well, this is the question I want to interrogate this, right? Because Philip K. Dick writes more novels than any man should be allowed, frankly. At the peak of his usage was using $2,000 a month in today's dollars of amphetamines.
Woo!
Right. Did this, and that was the peak. He did them for years, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, part of the question is like, can you write all of that? Is it possible to write all of this without some sort of stimulant? I don't know. I mean, he ranks up there with the most, you know.
So the only other writer I can think of off the top of my head who's got that kind of hypergraphia is like Stephen King, also famously, you know, was doing at his peak probably equivalent dollars worth amount of cocaine when he was writing in his middle period.
I think there
was some car accident or something, and it, after which he started doing a bunch of drugs, and this led to this insane sort of prolific writing. I think there's probably something to that. I doubt any human can produce that much work without assistance, let's say.
Right.
What I would probably caution any writer thinking, I guess if I want to produce that amount of work, I got to use a bunch of drugs, is I think there's like diminishing returns. Okay. So quality does suffer with that kind of quantity at some point. And we discussed this on the regular pod, and look, I'm not one to be able to sort of criticize Philip K. Dick. He's a far greater writer than I'll ever hope to be. But again, the prose style is a little bit, as we were saying, utilitarian, I guess. It's sort of workmanlike. And I wonder if there's a trade-off between speed in terms of the amount of time it takes to produce a work and the ability to craft, let's say, sophisticated or more complex or art. You know, writing that has a little bit more artistry on the sentence level. I suspect there is. And Stephen King also, I would argue, is not the greatest prose stylist. And there may be some correlation there between the drugs being used to produce it, the speed at which it's written, and then that quality.
Yeah, no, and I'm glad you said that. And this is actually kind of what I wanted to get, part of what I wanted to get to is, so I'm a writer. I've written, getting close to finishing, well, really it's like my fourth novel, but it'll be like the second novel that anybody really reads. And I take my sweet time. Now I would love to finish it faster. That would be amazing if I could finish it in a year, say. But I have this thought now that with the pressures of the internet to constantly be delivering something, and with the show we are constantly delivering something, but there is something of a revolutionary act to take your time.
Yes.
To just I'm going to do this at the pace that makes sense for me, you know, not actually doing the work thing, not in a just like staring in the corner or, you know, or push or avoiding the task, but in an actual like, no, these things take time to develop. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to work at it over time the way, you know, most great novels took some time to do, frankly. And, you know, somebody spending 2-3 years on something. We just talked to Aaron Gwynn about his great novel, All God's Children. 5 years it took him to write that novel. He wrote 400 pages into it, and he just decided, you know what? The characters and the setting are all right, but everything else is wrong. I'm starting over. Right. So,
yeah. You know, all of this has me thinking a little bit about a subject we have coming up, Bukowski. And Bukowski very famously wrote very quickly, but he had that poetic sensibility where even at the sentence level, he had a style that you could maybe try to emulate. I think what we're saying here is that like PKD doesn't really have a sentence by sentence style.
Right.
Necessarily, but he gets the story told.
Yeah. He doesn't necessarily need to. Right. I mean, there's all kinds. Right. We're talking about him. So he's done something significant. Yeah. And I say this literally, he's like on my Mount Rushmore. So this
of course.
Like,
my feeling about this, you know, I'm a writer too, and I've been down that road, and, you know, novels that took 2-3 years to come to fruition. And then that discounts also like the editing and the hand wringing and the rewriting and, you know, the millions of things that go into putting an actual novel together. And I would just say, if I had some way to shortcut that process, I would do it. Okay. Mm-hmm. I would take that drug if it was available to me and it worked for me. I've tried writing with the use of stimulants of various kinds, and it just doesn't work for whatever reason. There, whatever part of my brain and psyche is devoted to producing, work that feels meaningful to me, you know, that sort of narrative corner of my brain, that deals with character and psychology and mood and stuff, it just gets switched off the moment I take stimulants. It's good for editing. Okay. I drink a ton of coffee. Yeah. And I'll, you know, one thing I've noticed, it's almost unintentional, but like in the winter, you know, I get like the flu or something, and I take some Sudafed, and man, like I can edit so quickly and like, I'm really focused on it. And so that works for editing. But again, when it comes to the writing part of it, man, it just isn't there. Yeah. You know, so I don't begrudge writers for doing whatever it takes. And anybody, you know, it's a torturing sort of process. It's just so difficult no matter how you do it. And so my feeling is do whatever it takes. But
yeah, I am in the do whatever it takes category, like and it's going to be different for every person. Yeah. I know, you know, I dabbled a couple, literally twice, I think, maybe three times, trying to take some Adderall writing. And I have to tell you, I was extremely productive, but I remember in particular one session I was really productive, and at the end of it I just thought like, I have to never do those again, because like I could like literally imagine myself like just never stopping taking them, right. And it's like, that was good for this session, but like I'm gonna destroy myself with this
the ubiquity of Adderall is shocking to me, because I hitherto principally a drinker. Not anymore. But that's a different story. But I've had access to Adderall, and I just, to me, it's just like a horror. My brain does not respond very well to whatever that is. And then the come downs to me are just like,
it's almost like suicidal.
Monstrous. The idea that like every third person is out there even taking like small doses of that. Listen, if it works for you, more power to you, but I don't have the brain chemistry to
do that. Well, it does make me wonder, because like I do think the psychotropic effects of these drugs does in and of itself comes through in the content of the work. I mean, I think
now, like cocaine, however,
Yeah. nice, healthy, natural cocaine.
Right.
Comes from a plant, Kevin.
I'm trad.
Are you? Yeah. I think the actual effects of these things come through in the art. Like, if you look at like Pynchon.
Yeah.
Pynchon, great stuff. That is the literature of weed, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, and it's, and this is not knocking it. It's brilliant work. But just the, and you can, if you're a person who has some experience with cannabis and you really think, like, try to imagine this is the talk of a stoner, it has the specific sorts of lateral connections that yeah. cannabis can elicit, right? Again, no judgment, good or bad, on that. That's just what
I'd be
is.
Willing to make a judgment on that. I think yeah. in 98% of cases, 99, and maybe even I'd go so far to saying is that Pynchon is the one exception to the rule that writing on weed and cannabis is a terrible idea and is going to produce shit. And it's almost universally the case. I think Pynchon is the exception there. And yeah. I think actually, you know, if you study like the life of most of these writers, who may well be known as drunks, you know, Hemingway, Faulkner, Fitzgerald, all these guys. They did a lot of their best writing sober, or at least like in Faulkner's case, you know, just hungover. You know, these guys weren't like boozing up. Well, maybe his like LA period where he was working in the movies, he was boozed up the whole time because he couldn't stand it there. But, you know, writing gets done predominantly sober. Again, maybe there are some exceptions for like uppers, some stimulants.
Yeah.
But I would hate to sort of lead young writers to impression that in order to succeed at this, you have to like sort of destroy your brain
you
manipulate your psyche with drugs. That's such, and I've seen, and the reason I point this out is not to kind of to be a scold or something, but you know, I spent a lot, without doxing, I've spent a lot of my life around young aspiring writers of one kind or another. And I've seen a lot of talented people who assume that that is the case, that that there's a prerequisite for being a good writer to be also a drunk or a sort of drug addict of one kind or another. And I think that's hugely mistaken. There's a sort of a survivor's fallacy there. Where you only know about these, they're the ones who made it, but there's a million other drunks who failed. And it's just these exceptional geniuses in the case of a Faulkner or something, or a, you know, a Pynchon who can actually get by and make a career and make quality art out of this.
You'll often find in a lot of cases too, that, well, their material circumstances were also wildly different from anything that we're dealing with now. Hemingway married money very fast twice.
So, if you don't have to worry about money at all, then certain things do become less of a detriment, right? Like
it's a very complicated sort of set of circumstances. Like Mamet, one of my favorite playwrights, you know, he had in one of his books is writing about coming up in Chicago, and this is not about drugs per se, but he was saying, don't have a backup plan. Anybody with a backup plan is never going to make it in the industry. It's like, bro, we are in such a different, in 2023, such a different like set of material circumstances for you and your friends in the 70s putting on little plays in Chicago.
That was literally back in the day where, like, if you had to, you could go down there and ask the guy for a job and get it.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I love it.
I mean, there are writers who did live that life. And like, you know, Cormac McCarthy, I may be getting some of the details slightly wrong here, but after he got out of the war, he was super poor, gets married, has his first son, and was just living in squalor. He got offered jobs to like go teach creative writing or this at that university after he published. I think it was Sutri that he finally kind of got on the map, but he was still very poor. And he turned it down because he said, if I go teach, you know, I'm not going to have any money. Or if I go teach, I'm not going to have any time to like write. And so he did it and he pulled it off. And I think Coca-Cola ended up giving him a ton of money. And then, of course, he wins the MacArthur and all that stuff. So it worked out for Cormac McCarthy.
Coca-Cola.
Okay. If you're at the level of genius of Cormac McCarthy, fine. Okay. Go for it. Like you can take that risk. Mere mortals among us. I mean, you have to have some stability in your private personal life so that you can be wild in your sort of creative life.
Yeah, that's the Flaubert axiom that I have after some dissolute wild years, I have come to take as religion, basically.
And, you know, it may mean getting started a little later. It may mean getting distracted or taking 5 years to finish a goddamn novel instead of two or whatever it is. But if the... on the other side of that, you know, you have a stable life, you can afford to take care of your family and all that kind of stuff. And you don't have to be a sort of sad sack drunk who's getting by paycheck to paycheck or just hoping, praying for some kind of break that in, frankly, the current year publishing world is not coming your way. So,
yeah, you wonder. Well, the thing I wonder about a person like Cormac McCarthy is like, does he get published in today's milieu? Probably not.
No, yeah. I really don't think so.
Yeah.
On
some level, he would.
If he comes out of the gates writing, you know, Blood Meridian, or he just starts with Sutri, okay, maybe. Yeah. But you don't just start there. That's the thing. It's like you have to have those first couple of novels, you know, I think Outer Dark and whatever the other ones are.
Orchard Keeper. Outer Dark's brilliant, but I'm like I'd be surprised as a first novel.
I don't know, man.
It did, but I don't think it didn't.
No, I mean, like, does that get published today?
Oh, now.
If you show up at a major publisher or send that manuscript to an agent. Look, you can never say these things for sure, but I have a very strong suspicion that that does not see the light of day. That never makes it to the editor's desk.
Begs the question, like, are there major publishers anymore? Right? Like, what is it even anymore?
I mean, passage. I mean, I don't mean to shill here, but
not at all. Shill away.
This is the reason that, you know, I've kind of taken my life off the track that it was on and moved it onto this one, because that doesn't exist anymore. Those stories do not get a fair hearing. They don't get any hearing at all. And our culture suffers because of that. And everything that sort of comes out of the second order effects of having a vibrant, strong culture are deteriorated as a result. And so there needs to be some corrective action there. And no, the answer is none of the major publishers that are all consolidated now by like two main ones. I mean, it's like Bertelsmann's. And you know, whatever Simon and Schuster is under now, which I think is also owned by a German, it's owned by Viacom, actually.
I'm sure. Yeah, of course. That's what all those vertically deals are. Integrated. They don't even care. So they don't even care.
The whole point of the publishing industry is to push out 20,000 shitty books they don't give a shit about in the hopes that one of them becomes a hit.
Hunger Games.
Might, it may not. Yeah, it's just pure power laws. Yeah. They don't care about the quality. It's 100% about quantity. It's just noise. It's just feeding the content machine. So no, there really aren't editors, agents who are... Now, this is speaking very broadly here. You know, I'm sure there are some people out there who are trying their best. But even I would say it's more likely than not that those people are infected by the exact same brain worms, if on a slightly lesser scale... than the major publishers are, and because all of the incentives and social, not just business incentives, but social and cultural incentives are aligned to support and promote the existence of those brain worms. I mean, not having those brain worms is like social suicide. You sort of have to have it to survive. So anyway, I'm getting off on a tangent.
No, that's all good, man. I'm nodding my head over here. It is funny because there's been some stats have come out, you know, in the last year or two, and I don't know what asterisks you have to put next to them exactly, but there was a stat I saw recently that like Penguin Random House, the average book that they put out sells 200 copies. Now, I don't know that that's actually true, but
I think that's high. I'm serious. Right. I mean, I've seen that some of these numbers. I've been inside this a little bit now, and we've looked into the numbers and we've modeled out, the Amazon rankings are a pretty good proxy for sales. I mean, you can just extrapolate from those what, you know, retail sales are, et cetera. 200's high. Honestly,
that's crazy.
Yeah, it's really kind of bizarre what this business model is. It all That's hinges great. On selling a million Michelle Obama biographies,
right.
Okay, so that you can then justify the expense, which really aren't that high, you know, because the other thing that's happening here is author advances are virtually nothing now. I mean, it's low four-figure advance, okay, is like...
Barf. So,
they don't give you anything. Yeah.
It's really bad, man. It's really bleak out there. They do nothing to promote your work. If it doesn't take off immediately, if it's not going to immediately be sold to HBO to be optioned for a series or a movie or whatever, they don't do to put any work into promotion, marketing, nothing. They just let it wither on the vine.
Well, and honestly, a lot of these things are sort of ghost towns anyway. And this was really informative to me. I got retweeted by the Parish Review the other day, right?
That's a
million
deal.
Followers.
It would have been. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, for the pod, which is like we're a little podcast that we do effectively in our
deal. Okay.
Well, right. No.
And
right,
it got 7,000 impressions. when we do this tweet, I don't know what it'll have. It'll have way more impressions. Right. So how does that even
the Lomez bump on the Bird website is going to be bigger than the Paris Review? I'm not joking.
It's funny.
It's also astroturfed and fake.
Yeah. Well, look at Lauren Stein. Okay. Here's a perfect example of a guy kind of like operating on the outside edge of the quote unquote cathedral. Okay. You know, a prestige literature, Paris Review, Lauren Stein. Sorry. For people who don't know, Lauren Stein was the editor of the Paris Review throughout like the early 2000s into the 2010s. They were still doing some interesting stuff here and there, but you kind of started to see the worm turn in, I don't know, 2012-ish, 13. I mean, you know, one reason maybe all of us are on this conversation together is because we were right there as this turn was happening. Kind of radicalized in the same way.
Oh, bro. Okay. I mean, No docs.
Someone right. I know. But,
Lomez is the director of the Iowa Writers Workshop. That's the...
Formerly.
Yeah,
right. So Lauren Stein, though, you know, he gets kicked out of Paris Review. Mm-hmm. So even Paris Review, you know, that's this leading outside edge of what's acceptable in prestige literature. Mm-hmm. You know, he goes away. I think he was involved in some kind of Me Too scandal or whatever.
Oh, sure.
And he's off. He's got his own little publishing imprint that's actually doing some interesting stuff, but it's all reprints of like old obscure novels that like 10 people have read.
That's the way to go.
And so now it's just like Cat People. You know, Cat People is the only short story that anybody's read in the last, I don't know, 10 years. I mean, it's so depressing. Utter state of
absolutely
literature. My God. What a disaster.
Don't even get me started on the theater.
And what writer of worthy of the name, okay, artist worthy of name would want to be constrained by that environment?
And, yeah, that's the kind of reaction I started to have. So I got rejected by that whole industry, you know, 1,000 times over. And then there is a point like in the last year or two where I'm like, yeah, maybe that was good.
It's hard to know. Right. It's hard to know if that's what you even want anymore. Like, as an American playwright, I'm supposed to want to go and strike with the WGA, and I'm supposed to be in L.A. on my TV show for 6 months out of the year to then go fund my play in New York. And it's like, that's like being the belle of the ugly stick prom, you know, like, really what I want?
Right.
Like to me,
because I grew up sort of fantasizing about that world and, you know, I would imagine when I was a young person, you know, I would watch like, Hunter Thompson on like Charlie Rose's show.
Yeah.
I'd be like, oh my God, that's amazing. Like what I would give to have the opportunity to have a conversation like that, you know,
a rock star.
And so, okay. And then at some point you realize this isn't here anymore. This isn't available, not just to you, but it just doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. This older world, and it's regrettable. And you go, well, maybe that's a good thing. And really, my sort of whole trajectory through this is now finally just been to say, okay, be resigned. That's just what it is. It's neither good nor bad. It just is the way it is. So now what? Mm-hmm. You ask yourself that question. And my answer to that question is, okay, let's now start over. Let's just start and build something from here. And, you know, I have friends still in that world, sort of reluctantly, and their, you know, short story collections might still be published here or there. Their novels are getting, you know, some attention here or there, but they're selling, honestly, and I'm not saying this sort of to brag or anything or to try to sell people on this project, but like, I know if I took that novel and put it under the Passage imprint, I can sell you more copies of your book than Penguin can. I just, I have seen the numbers. Okay. Crazy. I know I can do that for you as a publisher. Yeah. Not only that, like I can, not I, I'm saying I, I'm just saying we can like put you in front of an audience where there will be a line out the door. I mean, we had this live event the other night in LA, very word of mouth. We didn't really advertise it much at all. We thought, we didn't know how many people would be there. It was, we show up the event. There's a line like out the door, standing room only at this event. It's like, it's not like old ladies with their NPR tote bags. There's like young youthful energy there. People showing up because they're excited to like hear what these people have to say. You know, it's a reading. It's a, like a literary reading. Okay.
Yeah.
I've been to hundreds of these things over the last 10 years. This is the first time I can recall there being any real life at one of these things, like a real audience. So anyway,
that I rocks, think, dude. Well, when it's time for us to do Art of Darkness live in LA, we'll get in touch. And I'm, or, you know, I mean that. Yeah, for real. Yeah.
And that so rocks, man. I'm not in LA, by the way. No docs.
No.
I'm not in LA, by the way.
Yeah, you're not in LA. No, but you threw up, but you threw a party.
But you know some, you know some people there that can help.
I know some people. Yeah. So anyway, I'm. This is very long-winded, self-serving thing for me to say, but. Well, I just want to impart on anybody listening this, there is hope, okay? There is like a way out of this sort of malaise and this sort of stuck culture that we're in. And it's a long road to sort of ever get to the point where there's a Charlie Rose-like figure interviewing our best authors on PBS. I mean, will we ever get there? I don't know. But there is a way out of this that's sort of hopeful, where there can be art that flourishes and writing that flourishes, good work.
Yeah.
Where writers and creators are allowed to express like the full scope of their artistic vision. Yeah. So anyway, don't black pill. I don't want
no, amen, no black pill. Like there is with that, you. That thing that's important is there a lot of us had a dream. The dream's not dead. It's just that the world that we thought we could inhabit doesn't exist anymore. The old world's dying. Yeah. The new world struggles to be reborn. You got to get it. You just have to adapt to what's actually happening now, instead of thinking that you can
and not despair and focus on the art, focus on the work. And like this event Lomez was talking about, start putting it together, start putting together a community, a coalition. This is why I do theater. I'm a big localist politically, among other for other reasons. And we'll have 30 people out for this Art of Darkness live in a week or two on a Monday in St. Paul, Minnesota. Right. And that's not at a local brewery, and that's not nothing, you know? And so
people are really hungry for this stuff, man.
Yeah.
If you give them something to feed on, they'll be there. You know, if there's meat on that bone, they'll show up.
Mm-hmm. Lomez, Mulholland Drive, best neo-noir or
no.
Okay.
No. Okay. I like Mulholland Drive, and I love Lynch, as we discussed earlier, but I think actually the Twin Peaks sequel is better. And actually the
season three, you mean?
Yeah. Season three.
Season three Showtime, is crazy good.
Whatever the Showtime one is called. Yeah, is it called the sequel?
The Return.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I think is a kind of synthesis of all of David Lynch's work. It's kind of like David Lynch open world. And if you recall, in that season, which I need to revisit and watch again, but there's all these allusions to Mulholland Drive, including the actors who show up. The whole Vegas scene, the guy who's at the the guy's name in Twin Peaks, but it's the same guy who goes behind the dumpster, the famous Winky's dumpster scene. He's the executive in Vegas. And there's this. I'll have to sort of pass on an analysis of Mulholland Drive to explain why it's not my favorite, because it's sort of a, controversial. Not controversial, but you know, I like Lost Highway better, actually. Lost Highway is more interesting.
And, Lost Highway is great.
Yeah,
Lost Highway is genuinely scary.
Yeah, it's really weird, and it's Kino in a way that, you know, all those scenes where the guy's on the phone, he's saying he's like in his house right now. It's just so good. Yeah.
Just terrifying.
And Baltazar Getty's so good in that as well. Mm. But I don't know. Okay, but are those noirs?
See, I think they're Paul Schrader type noirs, but they're not Western, the extension of the Western trope type noirs. That's my take on that anyway.
Is there a figure within that those worlds who are like attempting to bring order to this chaos or like resolve it in some way, or who are called into like moral duty?
I mean, Twin Peaks, there is sort of Mulholland, for sure. Mulholland Drive. There isn't. It's been so long since I've seen that. I kind of just remember it as still images. I don't even remember.
Yeah. I don't think Mulholland Drive. You could make the case that there is.
They do call them neo-noir, but that's just Wikipedia.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about Mulholland Drive is it comes a lot of it is inspired by Hermann Hesse's Steppenwolf, if I understand correctly.
Oh, it's interesting.
And that bounds up the whole influence of German expressionism on noir films anyway. So there is like this interesting sort of German connection to these things, but
Completing the system of German idealism
with some pretty hot
scenes there in the middle of it. So maybe that's what it was.
Too much.
Maybe that's what it was.
Yeah.
Well, Lomez, you were
I was just gonna say. I think Lynch's best expression of noir is definitely Twin Peaks. It's most, you know, it very clearly has sort of noir elements, you know, with the detective. Although in the case of Twin Peaks, what is interesting is that it's northern noir in the way that we described earlier. Cooper is like, he's like very clearly and unambiguously good. And he's facing off against a very clearly and unambiguously bad and evil, the evil presence of like Bob is like the incarnation of this evil. And so it doesn't quite have the same moral sort of ambivalence that, you know, we were talking about with like, let's say Blade Runner or sort of Philip Marlowe's characters in the big, or Chandler's characters in The Big Sleep. So it's more northern. It's got that, it's more Fargo-esque, the kind of almost naive innocence of the good cop or good authority figure whose authority is justified by his moral virtue. Mm-hmm. Whereas like what we might call like the Eastern noir or the Eastern or the Southern authority, whoever is the authority figure, that's not justified at all. They're corrupted in some way. And so that's maybe a difference there. Maybe Lynch has never done like a pure noir.
I don't think he
is.
His characters
are too good.
I think in Twin Peaks, the ambiguity, he's ambiguous about reality.
Blue Velvet would probably qualifies as pure noir.
But even Dale Cooper, he's not Cooper in Blue Velvet, but whatever his character's name is,
Jeffrey.
Yeah, but is he. Is there any ambivalence in his moral virtue?
Oh yeah, I guess so. With what he does with this woman, and he's sort of half dating. He takes this high school, virginal high school sweetheart, and turns her and like involves her in this horrific plot. Yeah, well, we could go for another hour. Lomez. Thank you so much for calling in from Iowa City, where you are leading the writers' workshop.
Keep those kids in shape out there.
That's right. Yeah. But really, seriously, don't do drugs, kids.
No, that's
like,
my
you don't
wife.
Need it.
My wife runs the Iowa Writers Workshop.
Oh, very
actually,
good.
You know what? No, you know whose wife does run the Iowa Writers Workshop or is a teacher there is Will Wilkinson.
He's Will Wilkinson.
You know, he's like Niskanen Center, Cato Institute, like libertarian leftist.
Interesting.
Anyway,
it's all connected.
Who wrote this awful awful like DC like gossip novel about like DC think tanks, like romance gossip novel. Yeah, exactly.
Oh man, yeah,
gross. Oh, yeah. I don't want to think about that.
If you ever wanted to experience some like raw, uncut cringe,
right into my veins.
Good play. Yeah, that's a good place to start.
It's only cringe if it comes from the cringe region of France. Lomas, thank you so much. You're welcome on anytime. You got something you gotta promote. Great. You know, you got something going on. You know, your revolving door, passage.press, and you know where to find us, artofdarkpod.com. Thanks for supporting.
I'd love to come on and talk more books at some point. We can pick another author, genre, or something. This was great.
Yeah, we'll look for connections, man, and we'll find some for sure.
Cool.